So, let you know where we're going in this last session. Are you still full of energy?
Yes.
Oh, surprised at the quick response there. Yes, very good. We're going to look, then, at understanding the characters in Bible stories. We're going to go through a few steps in this as how we can appreciate the way in which biblical characters are presented in the stories. And then I've got one final exercise to give you to send you on your way rejoicing. All right? Now, understanding Bible characters. Now, we just looked at the plots of Bible stories, and now we're going to look at characters. There's an obvious connection between the plot of a story and the characters in the story. So, the characters determine how a plot unfolds, right? So how a story is going to work out depends on what characters say and do. If this character decides to do this rather than that, well, the story is going to move in a different direction. So characters determine how a plot unfolds, but then the plot, you know, you look at, the plot that we just looked at of David and Bathsheba, for example, the plot illustrates the nature of those characters, because it's the nature of the characters that has determined the plot. Okay, so there's a circular relationship between characters and plot. Now, I'm going to use a word which I probably just need to explain a little bit. I'll talk about characterization. It's got quite a few syllables in it, but it's fairly simple. Characterization in a story simply means how characters are presented and what we might deduce from that as to whether that character is good, bad, ambiguous, vain, righteous. Okay? How the narrative, how the story characterizes is a way in which we're saying, how does the story present the characters? What does it tell us? What does it not tell us, and what function does this character have? Now, it's helpful if we think of characters that appear in biblical stories as belonging to one of three types of character. The first type of character is a flat character, and a flat character is a character who has a single characteristic. He or she does not develop. They are often dull. All right. But as in life, so in the Bible, there are dull characters who do not develop. So an example of that is Nabal. We might want to have a quick look at that in 1 Samuel 25, verse 3. Nabal is the husband of Abigail. And this is one of those occasions where the narrator actually provides us with information. This isn't done very often, as we know. But here the narrator gives us information on what he's like. Notice what it says, verse 3. Now the name of this man was Nabal, and the name of his wife Abigail. The woman was clever and beautiful, but the man was surly and mean. Now, when I tell you that his name, Nabal, in Hebrew, his name means fool. It's presumably not the name his parents gave him. One would hope not. So here we've got a man whose name means fool. He is surly and mean. And you start reading the story, you work your way through to the end of 1 Samuel chapter 25. And what do you conclude? He's surly and mean. He doesn't develop, as most fools don't. If they developed, they wouldn't be a fool. probably, unless they're a worse kind of fool at the end than they were at the beginning. So Nabal is an example of a flat character. They just exemplify one virtue or one vice, and that's it. Then the second kind of character we have is an agent. And an agent is somebody in a story who is necessary to move the plot along. But once they've served their purpose, that's it. So, for example, we get this in, watching a film, a movie, giving a fairly banal example, we're watching a movie perhaps, and our hero needs to get from JFK Airport in New York to the United Nations building in order to save Western civilization. So he hails a taxi at the airport, and the taxi driver gets him from JFK Airport to the United Nations building, and Western civilization is saved. But that's the last we ever hear of the taxi driver. He was only necessary to get the hero from here to there. We're not really interested in him. He has a vital function of driving the fellow, but that's it. And you get agents in Bible stories too. You may remember the cupbearer or the butler in the story of Joseph. In the court, the Pharaoh has a dream and nobody can interpret it. And then the butler says, you know something? I remember I met a chap called Joseph in prison. Now, the butler, the cupbearer, is necessary in the telling of the story to get Joseph out of prison and into Pharaoh's court. But that is the last we ever hear of him. Anybody who attempts to preach a sermon on the cupbearer is going to give thin gruel to the congregation, because he's simply an agent in the story. His personality, character, doesn't develop. Then, third character, type of character, are round characters. Now, these are the really interesting ones. These are the ones that we often need to concentrate on, because these are the ones which convey more information. A round character. Well, a round character is a significant character given enough space to develop in the story. So an example of that, we looked at Genesis 18, where Abraham is arguing with God. But we have the entire story of Abraham, don't we? From chapter 12 through to chapter 25. And Abraham's present in almost every episode. So we get to know Abraham as a round character. And he is far more interesting than most people give credit for. He isn't always the member in good and regular standing, should we say. And if you don't believe me, then ask Sarah. She'll put you straight on what living with Abraham was like some of the time. So Abraham is round, complex. That's another way of looking at round characters. They're complex characters. That makes them interesting, because they develop over time. We get to know more about this character in this particular episode or in the larger story. So those are the three kinds of characters. And so when we are coming then to reading a Bible story, there is no story without characters. So you're going to have characters in your story. It's helpful to ask, what kind of a character am I dealing with here? Is this character flat? Is this character an agent? Or is this character round? Okay? So let me illustrate that by taking a look at one of the longer stories that we have in the Gospels, in John chapter 9. This is the story of the blind man. Now, this is a fairly long story for New Testament standards, it's over 40 verses. So I'm not going to read the whole story. I assume most of us have got a memory of John 9, the story of the blind man, but I'm going to summarize it for you, okay? So I give you the main bullet points of this story. The disciples see a man who was born blind, and they ask Jesus, who sinned, this man or his parents? And Jesus says, they're asking the wrong question. This comes back to the point I think Doug was making, you know, that somebody asks a question and that Jesus' response isn't the answer, but moves them in a different direction. And then Jesus heals the man. And those who know the man are unsure whether he's the same man or not. Are you sure this is the same blind beggar? He looks like him. I'm not sure. The man tells them that Jesus actually gave him his sight. Yeah, I am the blind beggar. I should know. And the Pharisees are then divided over whether Jesus is from God or not, since he healed on the Sabbath. I mean, surely if he's a man of God, he would have waited until the sun had gone down before healing the man who'd been born blind. This isn't an emergency. He's been blind all his life. Why sully the sacred hours of the Sabbath by healing him this side of sunset rather than the other? And they question the man's parents. Are you sure this is your son? Are you sure? And it continues. The man once again says, Jesus gave him his sight. And the Pharisees repeat. Well, we've got some repetition, as you can see, going through the story. The Pharisees repeat, Jesus cannot be from God for the reasons we've just stated. He doesn't fit our theological mold, so he can't be from God. The man testifies to his faith in Jesus. And Jesus meets the man again, and the man acknowledges Jesus as the Son of Man. And Jesus announces that he came to give sight to the blind, while those who think they can see are actually blind. In summary, that's the story, okay? Just to remind ourselves of the main characteristics. Let's now have a look at the characters in this account. We'll start by looking at the disciples. We find the disciples in verse 2, and they ask one theological question. Remember what the question they asked? Master, who sinned, this man or his parents? Because, like some people I meet when I speak in churches on Sabbath afternoons, there are some people who like to ask awkward questions. The disciples are in that category too. So, the disciples are agents because their question sets in train the whole series of events in John chapter 9, but we never hear from the disciples again. You follow me when I'm saying that he's an agent? We never hear from them again, but they ask one question because that is necessary to get us into this story. And then, let's take a look at Jesus, who's clearly one of the major characters in the story. Jesus pronounces, I am the light of the world, in verse 5. In verses 6 to 7, he gives sight to the blind man. Then in verse 35, oh, by the way, you notice there's a big gap between here and here. So Jesus is absent for a fair bit of this story. He asks the blind man if he believes. Then in verse 39, he says he came into the world so that the blind might see, and vice versa, that those who think they can see are actually blind. And he tells some of the Pharisees that they are blind. So what kind of a character is Jesus? Well, in this story, Jesus is a flat character. Now I need to pause here because I normally detect resistance at this point. What do you mean Jesus is a flat character? He is the Messiah, the Son of God. Yes, when we say, what I'm saying, that Jesus is a flat character, I'm not judging Jesus negatively. I'm not making a judgment on his character. I'm saying, what function does he have in this story? And remember our definition of a flat character. A flat character exhibits one quality which doesn't deviate, it doesn't develop. And so if you look at what Jesus does here, he pronounces, I'm the light of the world. He gives sight to the blind man, asks the blind man if he believes, says he came into the world so the blind might see, vice versa. He tells some of the Pharisees that they are blind. That is, everything that Jesus says and does relates to light and darkness, seeing and blindness. But Jesus doesn't develop. You know, he doesn't then go on to talk about the age of the earth or women's ordination or anything like that. He's still on light and darkness, sight and blindness. So he's a flat character, essentially one characteristic repeated throughout. And by the way, sometimes flat characters can be very interesting characters because they contrast with round characters. And it's actually the contrast between somebody who does not deviate with somebody who is moving and developing all the time. Third character, the blind man. Let's see what we're told about the blind man. The blind man, well, actually, he starts off, of course, begging. I should have included that detail first, I suppose. But then he goes and washes in the pool of Siloam because Jesus tells him to do that. Verses 8 to 9, he insists he really is the beggar who was blind. He used to sit there and beg. Verses 11 to 12, he tells the people how he was healed. He tells the Pharisees how he was healed. He says that Jesus is a prophet in verse 17. Verse 25, he says he doesn't know if Jesus is a sinner or not. Verse 27, he asks the Jews if they want to be Jesus' disciples. He gets a little bit sarcastic in the story. Would you like to be his follower too? No. Verses 30 to 33, he confesses that Jesus is from God. He believes Jesus is the Son of Man and worships him in verse 38. So what kind of a character is the blind man in this story? He's a round character. He's a round character because he develops throughout the narrative. Okay, so he moves from saying he doesn't know if Jesus is a sinner to saying he definitely is not. So there's movement, there's development, and therefore, as far as the characters we've looked at, as a character in the story, the blind man is the really interesting character for us to concentrate on. So in this narrative, who is the major character? I'd say it's not the disciples. They appear in verse 2 and we never hear from them again. They're just agents. As a character, it's not actually Jesus so much in this story because he's absent for well over 20 verses. The really major character, I'd say, is the blind man because he's the most complex. And because in this narrative, the emphasis in this episode is on how the blind man relates to Jesus rather than how Jesus relates to the blind man. Now, of course, Jesus does relate to the blind man. That's clear. But more important is how does the blind man relate to Jesus? So if we are reading the story and we're wanting to ask some personal questions on the basis of this characterization, we could ask ourselves, which blind man are you? Because several blind men in the story, Are you the blind man who says Jesus is a prophet? Or are you the blind man who isn't sure if Jesus is a sinner? Or are you the blind man who knows Jesus is not a sinner? Or are you the blind man who's willing to worship Jesus as the Son of Man? Which blind man am I? Because this blind man moves from this to this to this to this. One way of putting it then is try to identify with the major character, the major round character, and say, where am I in this? Because I think most people's, sorry, I shouldn't use the word prejudice, but most people's hunch would be that any story in the Gospels, Jesus must be the major character. Well, of course, in some ways he is, but he's not a round character. It's the blind man, because this story wants us to identify with the blind man. Okay then, in a little more detail then, I'm going to look at ways in which Bible stories present characters and how they characterize them. Look first of all at three ways in which they do it. And in this section, we're going to be revising some points we've already made. Okay, because I realize it's late in the day and it's becoming increasingly difficult to keep up. All right, so we're going over some material. And it's increasingly difficult for me to think of anything original. Okay, so that's another reason as well. One way in which we learn more about characters is through physical description, when we have it, which we don't have all that often, through their inner thoughts, which of course we're not given that frequently, and a lot through what people say and do, through their speech and action. So let's have a look at how these can convey to us something about the characters, the personalities of the characters we're looking at. In Judges chapter 3, verse 17, then he presented the tribute to King Eglon of Moab. Now, Eglon was a very fat man. Not just fat, but I mean very fat. How many other very, very fat men are there in the Bible? There aren't any. We're told that Eli was heavy, but then he was almost 100 years old, so, you know. But there, nobody else is called very... Now, who is King Eglon? Well, he's king of Moab, and he is receiving tribute, protection money from Israel. And this king, receiving protection money from Israel, is very fat. What does that tell us about King Eglon? Yeah, he's living, no pun intended, but he's living off the fat of the land. All right. He's receiving an awful lot of tribute, and he's liking this very much, thank you. Keep it coming. Because if there's one thing I want to be, is even fatter than I am. Okay. He's a very fat man. So the physical description gives a hint as the kind of person we're dealing with. And then, of course, we've already seen this once or twice already. Absalom cut the hair of his head, but at the end of every year, he used to cut it when it was heavy on him. He weighed the hair of his head, 200 shekels by the king's weight. This is vanity on stilts, okay? So the physical description of his hair, we've seen this before. So that is one way in which we get an idea what a character is about without the narrator saying, now, Absalom's a vain fellow. He could have said that, but instead he says it more interestingly this way. Then inner thoughts. Now, Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing with which his father had blessed him, and Esau said to himself, "The days of mourning for my father are approaching, when I will kill my brother Jacob." We saw this briefly before. Esau said to himself, this is what's in his head. He's not screaming it from the hilltops for everybody to hear. This is in his mind. It tells us something about what Esau is like at this stage in his life. He will appear later, and if I remember, I'll come back to what he does later. We saw this too, didn't we? Then she said, "The Philistines are upon you, Samson." And when he awoke from his sleep, he thought in his mind, "I will go out as at other times and shake myself free." But he did not know. He did not know that the Lord had left him. What kind of character doesn't know that? What kind of character can end up in this kind of a situation? So those are inner thoughts. And then, remember, I mentioned, yesterday in the first session, that generally speaking, in a biblical narrative, we are left with what characters say and what characters do in order to assess them, to judge them. So let's unpack that a little bit more than we've done already. One question we can ask when we see what somebody says or do is to ask the question, why do characters speak or act as they do? Why do that? Why say that? For example, Genesis 4, 4 to 5. "And the Lord had regard for Abel and his offering, but for Cain and his offering, he had no regard." Remember that in most Bible stories, God is a character also, isn't he? Along with the human characters, God is a character. Why did God have no regard for Cain's offering? If we haven't read the story, we have a ready answer, most of us. It's only when you read the story, you discover that the answer isn't quite so obvious. Now, I think the story reveals why God had no regard for Cain's sacrifice, but it's a little more subtle than is usually thought. But that's the question. You see, here we're simply told what the Lord did, but not why he did it. Where are we going to find the answer, would you say? If you want to know why the Lord had no regard for Cain and his offering, where are you going to go to find out?
What happened next?
Yeah, you're going to read the story. Read the story. Quite often when I ask that question, people say, "Read a commentary." No. No. Read the story. And then you'll find out whether the commentary is correct or not. I had a professor once who said, "Read the Bible. It sheds some very interesting light on the commentaries." Second Samuel 11. When Uriah came to him, David, no, just the background to this, remember, David has seen Bathsheba, he's had his way with her, she is pregnant, and now he says, bring Uriah back home. Now, I wonder why he wants Uriah to come back home. I wonder why, because the Bible doesn't say. When Uriah came to him, David asked how Joab and the people fared and how the war was going. Has the weather been fine in your part of the, you know, passing the time of day? And then says, look, go down to your house and wash your feet. If you think there's a little innuendo there in English translation, it's even more obvious in the Hebrew. Why do you think David wants Uriah to go home and spend some time with his wife?
So that the baby is his.
Yeah, that is the obvious answer, isn't it? But notice, nowhere does the story ever tell us that. We deduce that from what he says. And so we are the ones making judgments on David. And so we're saying, you rotter. Because when David does what he did with Bathsheba and then says, look, get Uriah to come back, we might well be expecting him to say, hello, Uriah. It's good to see you. One or two things I need to tell you. Look, it was like this. That could be the reason for bringing him home, wouldn't it? In fact, that might be the honourable thing to do. But he doesn't do that. He does this. And we judge what his motive is, even though the story never explicitly gives it to us. So this is the way in which we are making judgments on the characters. And then something else is the character telling the truth? Now, this is one of the problems, you know. You're reading scripture, this is the word of God, and this is where truth is found. But in Bible stories, are you sure this character is telling the truth? That's the point here is in Genesis 50, in the story of Joseph. Jacob has died. You know, Joseph is still in charge in Egypt, and his brothers are now fearful. Realizing that their father was dead, Joseph's brothers said, what if Joseph still bears a grudge against us and pays us back in full for all the wrong that we did to him? So they approached Joseph saying, your father, notice not our father, but anyway, your father gave this instruction before he died. Say to Joseph, I beg you, forgive the crime of your brothers and the wrong they did in harming you. Now, therefore, please forgive the crime of the servants of the God of your father. Joseph wept when they spoke to him. Now, first of all, do you believe the brothers? Did Jacob say that? We don't know. But if he did say it, this is the first we've heard of it. So are you going to believe the brothers? Are they telling the truth? Or do you think there's enough in these words to suggest they might be economical with the truth? Joseph wept when he heard it. Why do you think he wept?
Hmm. So this is why they knew that it might be only by the time he died that he's going to
find. Does the Bible tell us why Joseph wept? No. So we've got to ask, why is it? You know, is it this reason or is it that reason? If we think that they're telling fibs, does he weep because he twigs? Oh, goodness. They're at it again. Have Joseph's brothers told lies before? Could they be telling lies again? Well, they could. Well, not necessarily, of course. Just because you tell a lie once doesn't mean to say you're doing it for the rest of your life. But you see, we have got to make a judgment here. And how are you going to make up your mind? You make up your mind by going back and rereading the story. How does this fit in with the rest of the story? And of course, I can't do that for you. So when you get home, you read the story, right? Then what tone of voice is a character assuming? You know, somebody says something, but what tone of voice are they using? You know, if we had a recording, we could hear the tone of voice, but all we got are the words on the page. Let me read this as flat and as in such a dull manner as I can muster, without any tone of voice, and then we'll see what the possibilities are, right? Now the angel of the Lord came and sat under the oak at Ophrah, which belonged to Joash the Abiezrite, as his son Gideon was beating out wheat in the winepress to hide it from the Midianites. The angel of the Lord appeared to him and said to him, "The Lord is with you, you mighty warrior." Gideon answered him, "But sir, if the Lord is with us, why then has all this happened to us? Where are all his wonderful deeds that our ancestors recounted to us, saying, 'Did not the Lord bring us up from Egypt?' But now the Lord has cast us off and given us into the hand of Midian." I've been in some churches where my scripture reading has been read in that, that same manner. Now, but what tone of voice are you going to give the characters? Because the tone of voice you give is going to indicate how you are interpreting what is being said and done. Now, what is Gideon doing? He is hiding from the Midianites, right? In a wine press. And the angel comes along. So he's hiding from the enemy, and the angel says, does he say this? "The Lord is with you, you mighty warrior." Hiding in the wine press. Right? Is that the tone of voice? Or is it, "The Lord is with you, you mighty warrior"? And what about Gideon? Is Gideon a polite southern Englishman? But sir, if the Lord is with us, why then has all this happened to us? And where are all his wonderful deeds that our ancestors recounted to us, saying, "Did not the Lord bring us up from Egypt? But now the Lord has cast us off, as it were, and given us into the hand of Midian." Is that the tone of voice? Or is it, "Sir, if the Lord is with us, why then has all this happened to us? And where are all his wonderful deeds that our ancestors recounted to us, saying, 'Did not the Lord bring us up from Egypt? But now the Lord has cast us off and given us into the hand of Midian.'" Now, is that the correct tone of voice? You see, the tone of voice we give the characters will reveal how we are interpreting, what kind of character they are. And so before you assign a tone of voice, you need to find out from the context, from what is said and the rest of the story, what is the most likely tone of voice. All right, so we've looked at these: physical description, inner thoughts, speech and actions, and then the final one I want to look at is this, and that is contrast. And I would say that probably this is one of the major ways in which the Bible makes characters live. It does it through contrasts. Various kinds of contrasts. So quickly go through this. You have contrast with another character or other characters. In Genesis 38, we have the story of Judah and Tamar. You all remember that general story of Judah and Tamar. And in verse 26, Judah says something very significant. Remember that Judah has ordered that Tamar be brought out and burned, and she holds up the staff and the cloak, and she says, "Oh, by the way, I don't know if anybody recognizes this, but these belong to the man who got me pregnant." You remember that part of the story? And then Judah says in verse 26, "She is more righteous than I." So the words of Judah himself contrast his actions with Tamar's actions. She is the one in the right, and he is the one in the wrong. So that kind of explicit contrast enables us to judge what kind of a character Judah is. Then we have another kind of contrast, which is a contrast with an earlier or a later action of the same character. Does this character develop in the episodes? Well, we come to Judah again. We saw Judah in chapter 38. Judah is not a positive character in chapter 38. You remember how Judah traps, sorry, how Tamar traps Judah? All she does is sit by the side of the road, looking like a prostitute. She doesn't have to say anything because she knows her father-in-law. He approaches her. So he's not a positive character. But in chapter 44, when Joseph says later on that you're going to keep Benjamin here and the rest of you can go back home to your father in Canaan. Remember that part of the story? Judah steps forward. Well, maybe I better summarize it because time is going. Judah steps forward and he says, look, our father's life is bound up with the life of Benjamin. If Benjamin does not go home, our father will die. Send Benjamin home and imprison me. Now, that's a rather different Judah, isn't it? From the Judah we met in chapter 38. So Judah has moved from being less righteous than Tamar, being a negative kind of a character, through to being a much more positive character. And that's a warning to us not to expect biblical characters to be completely consistent. They develop, they grow, they change. And Judah is an example of that. And another kind of contrast is the contrast with the expected norm. What would you expect the normal person, well, if you know what a normal person is, but what would you expect the average person to do in this situation? For example, Abraham's willingness to sacrifice Isaac. Take your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a sacrifice on one of the mountains that I shall show you. And Abraham says, well, in fact, he doesn't say anything. He just goes. Is that normal? Is that what the average person would do? Is that what you would do? In fact, is it what Abraham has done in previous episodes where he's argued with God? Remember, we saw him back in chapter 18 arguing with God, but this time he accepts him. So there's a contrast between what Abraham does and what we might judge would be the normal reaction of somebody. Now, the final point I want to make is this before I give you a quick, well, I hope a relatively quick exercise to do. When we look at all of the ways in which, sorry, let me go back on that. When we consider all of the information that Bible stories give us about characters, it might be helpful to look at this, what's called scale of certainty, all right? Let me explain this. It's Alter's scale of certainty. Alter, Robert Alter, a scholar, American scholar. I read his book called The Art of Biblical Narrative in 1983, and it was a road to Damascus experience for me in my interpretation and understanding of the Bible. What Alter's scale of certainty is this. He said, look at all the information that a Bible story gives you about a character or characters and rank them in this order. So let me explain. Of least importance, of some importance, but of least importance in judging a character are a character's actions or physical appearance. More important than that, a character's direct speech or what other characters say about him or her. That's going to be a little bit more helpful. Even more helpful, a character's inner speech or inner thoughts. And even more helpful than that, the narrator's explicit assessment of a character's actions or intentions. King so-and-so did evil in the eyes of the Lord. We don't really have the option to say, I believe he was an evangelical Adventist. No, he did evil in the eyes of the Lord. Explicit from. So let me summarize very quickly. Types of characters, remember. Flat, agent, round. And we get to know biblical characters largely through explicit assessment by the narrator, although that's rarely given. Their physical description, which again isn't given very frequently. Their inner thoughts, again given infrequently. Their speech and actions, which are given often, and contrasts with themselves and other characters, which happens often. That's how we build up and make an assessment of a biblical character. How are we going to judge Abraham or Daniel or Ahithophel based on looking at those aspects? More to the point, how are you going to assess King Darius in Daniel chapter 6? Because this is where Pastor Tompkins comes into his main role here.
Actually, I'm an agent.
You're an agent, yeah. You're an agent, yeah. We just need you to get this done. You don't serve any other purpose. No. So we've got a few minutes. So what I'd like you to do is to look at this. There are two sheets for each of you. This is the text of Daniel chapter 6. And what I would like you to do is to read that chapter with an eye on King Darius. Now, we don't have time to do everything that I would like to do, but I have made an executive decision. That executive decision is that King Darius is a round character. All right? Don't spend the time arguing with me because we don't have the time to do that. All right? It's an executive decision. How do you judge King Darius as a character, bearing in mind these things that you see on the screen there, okay? So take the time to read through, and as you come to what Darius says and does, or whatever the narrative says about him, how are you going to judge him? Based on the text, and the text only. So set your mind on that, and I'm going to sit down and take a little nap, and I'll be back in a minute. Okay, now ideally, you know, we'd spend much more time than this, but I need to cut this short in righteousness. So, what do you make of King Darius? So imagine King Darius is applying for a job and he's asked you to provide a reference for him. What are you going to say about him? If you raise your hand, and we'll get you to make comments.
In two sentences, I think that he was a fool and full of himself, vain king who supposed to act like the king, but he didn't when it's supposed to be. And eventually he changed through some, whatever he's supposed to do at first, he did last. And that's my characteristic of him.
Hmm. What would be the prime exhibit that you would give in support of what you said, you know, in the text? What prime example would you give?
So when he's vain and he's, you know, full of himself, when the guys came to him and asked him, I could live forever and we want to make a decree that you are the only one and who's supposed to be praised and ask right. for anything, and he liked this idea.
So an appeal to his sense of grandeur
ego,
and
yes,
vanity.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And then because he is a fool, he clearly don't see that they are plotting against, because he wanted to bring somebody to the top, and this guy who's supposed to be bring to the top is not with them. So right. he doesn't see that. So he's okay. A fool.
Right, okay, thank you. Right, anybody else want to add to this one here, yeah?
I'm not a bit in favor of dear old Darius. He was a well-organized guy. He mm-hmm. organized his kingdom well, and included this foreigner, Daniel, in his presidential settings up. He appreciated what Daniel's good spirit was. So he was basically, in context of his generation and where he lived and who he was, basically not a bad guy.
So he has some redeeming features.
He had some redeeming features. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. Anybody else?
You could say that he was discerning. You know, he mm-hmm. he made the decision to make Daniel chief. That was the cause of what the others did. So he was mm-hmm. discerning about Daniel's character, wasn't he, and ability. So, mm-hmm. yes, he was foolish and egotistical, maybe, mm-hmm. but he did have discerning qualities too.
So I'm picking up things here that he's a bit of a mixed character. Then he can assess who might do a good job, but on the other hand, he's got some flaws in his character. Yeah.
He had a problem making up his mind. He right. allowed others to tell him what to do.
Yes. Can you give an example of that?
Well, his leading cabinet ministers. Came in and told him, this is what you ought to do, and he did it.
Yeah.
And then they came back to him and said, Daniel is not listening, now you do this, and he did it, even yeah. against his better judgment.
Mm.
Easily led.
Easily led, okay, yes, okay.
Thank you. Easily led, but willing to learn.
Right.
Because once he had made a mistake, which he did, but he changed. And he was willing to try and do all he could. He searched the ways out, but when he couldn't do it, he honoured the God of heaven and prayed that the God of heaven mm-hmm. would be with Daniel.
Okay, so...
So he comes over a good guy in the end. I'd employ him, Lawrence.
In the Scottish mission, yeah. He suggests the church he'd like to go to, but...
I think Paul is far too soft. I'm with Thomas on this, and an old cynic... He may have been well organized, but the reason he was well organized is in the second verse, so that the king might suffer no loss. So it wasn't exactly disinterestedness. He wanted all the dosh, he wanted all the praise, and you can make an argument that when he saw the power of Daniel's God, he wanted that on his side as well. So all he's done is said, I want all the powerful stuff with me. There's no evidence anywhere in this story that he's actually changed his ways. He's just building a better and more powerful weapon.
Right, okay.
So why did he not be able to sleep at night? Yeah.
Because he was worried about his money.
I think there was a good side to him.
Yeah.
I'd like to disagree with Steve, because I think he more than made up for his error at the end. He could just have said, okay, Daniel, you continue to worship your God. I can see that's the right thing for you to do. But he doesn't. He commits himself and mm-hmm. makes a command that everybody has to worship Daniel's God. Mm. So I think he's truly converted.
Because that brings up an interesting connection. At the beginning of the story, there is a decree on who should be worshipped. And then there's a decree at the end of the story as to who should be worshipped. And how do you assess the contrast between the decree that it's got to be Darius and the decree that it's the God of Daniel? Is that positive, is that negative? You know? Yeah. Yes, Michael?
I think one of the things which comes out blatantly clear is that Darius is a legalist,
right.
And he's a Babylonian, no, he's a Medo-Persian legalist. He sets laws which cannot be changed, because that is how the country works.
Mm-hmm.
And when one law gets him into trouble personally because of his relationship with Daniel, he doesn't rescind the law, because he can't. He makes some more laws.
Mm-hmm.
And to develop that further, he makes another law about the worship. And where do we see legalism in that sort of context, I wonder? That's a rhetorical question.
Solve a difficult problem by passing another law. Okay.
The other thing I was going to add, he acknowledges Daniel's God, but he retains his cruelty when we read what he does to all the people who have tricked him.
Yes. Why does he do that to the people who tricked him? Why does he...
That's what they did.
He was embarrassed.
It's all about him.
Well, you see, you could argue that. You could argue, well, on the one hand, you can say this is justice. On the other hand, you can say he's getting rid of all those people who made a fool of him. And he doesn't want to be reminded of that every time he comes into the palace and sees those same people there. How are you going to judge him? Positively or not so positively?
And how could you trust, how could he trust those people who, you know, he trusted them, that they would, they'd come to him with all this. And how can he now trust their judgment about anything?
Because they've now been rumbled.
Yeah. They're really out to manipulate him.
Did you have a... we have one question here, then we get a microphone to you. Okay, sorry.
He was rather trapped in the culture of his nation because you have a similar setup with Mordecai and that, you know, that story.
Esther and
the laws
Ahasuerus.
Couldn't be changed. But when he realised his mistake, he got rid of the people who had caused it.
Okay. Then we have a comment over here.
You could say that he threw the other men into the den of lions to prove that the lions hadn't turned into pussycats.
Right. So this is quality control. Yeah, right. Yes.
I can see why people are being mean about Darius, but I mean, surely we can look at him and see ourselves. And the way that he behaved is the way that we behave. It's all about us. And the way that he acted and then felt overjoyed, but still, even though things happen to us and we're joyful, we still, part of us, want to seek revenge on those who have harmed us. So I think I can understand why people are feeling quite aggrieved about Darius, but still I think we have to look at him and see ourselves in him.
And of course, that's ultimately, I think, what these Bible stories are asking us to do. These aren't just giving us information. They're asking us to involve ourselves in this story. You know, where am I in this story? We don't want to be in the lion's den, obviously.
Well, verse 28 is the end of the story. That's the conclusion. So this Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian. God used Darius.
Yeah. So it works out well for Daniel. If it works out well for Daniel, it works out well for God's purposes.
Even though, as you mentioned before, he is a round character, I think that the amount of information that the Bible is able to provide on these characters tends to focus in on a couple particular characteristics to make the point of the story.
Okay.
I often, as I'm reading through these things, saying, how would I portray this? If I was making this into a movie and I didn't want this guy to come off as a two-dimensional cartoon character, what other factors are influencing his ideas and his thinking and his decisions and things like that. So, I think that the Bible is trying to emphasize a couple of key characteristics about Darius in order to make the point of the story and to show the progression
what are those
and the growth.
Couple of key characteristics.
Yeah, but he's clearly not that much of an idiot to be duped so easily and to be, you know, tricked and manipulated so easily and things like that. He is. In a particular context, he is the ruling person of the entire kingdom. He's probably not an idiot, but again, the Bible's choosing to try to emphasize a few of the characteristics so that it can make the point of the story.
Yes, I mean, the only access we have to what's going on are the details that this story gives us, so we can't then just speculate beyond the story. We've got to deal with what the story has given us. Well, I'm glad that that's clear then. But you see,
why do you think he is a
Yeah, I think he's obviously a round character because he's a complex character. And the temptation is for us to latch onto one detail, which might be positive. And if that one detail is positive, then he's obviously a positive guy. I'd like to be his next door neighbor. He'd be coming around, you know. Or we latch onto a negative aspect and say, well, he's a negative fellow. What makes him round is that he has characteristics of both. Unlike us, of course, because we're all consistently righteous. But Darius is complex. Is he capable of being stupid? Yes. Is he capable of succumbing to flattery? Yes. Is he capable of doing the right thing when he needs to? Yes. Is he capable of going too far in his throwing everybody to the lions? Well, that's debatable, you know, but it's probably not on the Scottish statute book, you know, that particular punishment. He's a mixed bag, right? And I think that we've got to live with that with biblical characters, because that's what makes them believable. Now, it's difficult to be objective about ourselves, you know, so think about somebody else in your church. Maybe somebody you don't get on with all that well, although you pray for them. Is that person all bad? Do they have any redeeming feature? And that's one of the things that we've got to ask ourselves when reading a story like this. Paul mentioned, you know, at the end, Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius after this. Darius gave him space to be the man that God wanted him to be, so that he is capable of serving a positive purpose. Does that mean that he's positive in everything? No. He's a mixed bag. And if truth were told, and you can ask my wife this, so am I. I'll send you on your way rejoicing.